car pulled up to Baltimore, and there was Charlie outside, and he opened my door, and I sat beside him for dinner, and we kind of became mates, I would say. I was interested in politics, he was interested in people who made stuff and did stuff, and he was very encouraging and remained very encouraging.
Hello and welcome to the Insights podcast with Sean O'Rourke. My guest is one of the best known Irish men on UK television, but it's his success within his chosen industry of gardening and landscaping away from television screens that truly sets him apart. Diarmaid Gavin became famous for his innovative creations at the renowned Chelsea Flower Show, and he counts royalty and dignitaries among fans of his work. But his road to success wasn't without its stumbles. In this conversation, Diarmaid opens up about why he wanted to change gardening forever. Also, the unwavering support of Terry Keane and her family, some of his high-profile commissions, including Harrods, and meeting the store's owner, Mohammed Al-Fayed. How he turned down a request to work in the presidential palace in Syria. All of that, and a glimpse of what's to come as he takes on his most ambitious projects to date. Diarmaid's been a very familiar figure on our screens for many years, but I have no doubt that in this conversation, you'll learn something new and get some real insights into my guest, Diarmaid Gavin. Diarmaid Gavin, it's great to have you in the Insights podcast studio. Thank you very much indeed for coming in. I realised in the last couple of days that you last year celebrated a big roundy birthday. What was that like for you, reaching the 6-0 mark?
I kind of ignored it. I just feel, you know, what's the alternative? It's great to be here. It's great to be working. It's great to be still doing something that I love doing. And I have a 20-year-old daughter, so I often see the world through her eyes. So there's a refreshment, let's say, going on.
You didn't find it daunting or anything like that, or a time for reflection? Maybe you think about maybe slowing down or taking on new challenges, whatever.
Certainly, I didn't think about slowing down. I think if you're a gardener, you're only beginning to get into your stride at this stage. It takes a long time to learn your trade and to understand how plants grow and seasons and the passing of time. So it all adds up.
Do you still consider yourself as driven now that you've hit the 60 mark, as you always were? Are you as obsessive about your profession as you always were?
Yes. Maybe even more so, because I've been given an opportunity, I've been given a voice, and I've been able to get some things built and made and planted and whatever.
I suppose at the peak of your fame, I'm not saying that, you know, you're not at the peak any longer, but there was a time where you could hardly turn on a television without seeing you. I mean, people talk about you making a splash. You actually were in a program called Splash. You were trying to be Ireland's answer to Tom Daly. I mean, was there anything you weren't prepared to try?
There was. I didn't go in the jungle when they asked me.
It's not too late, you know.
It's not too late. And actually, my daughter and her boyfriend are petitioning for me to join that particular thing. No, I did loads. I think the thing was, I got to the age of 30 and nobody had ever asked me to do anything. Nobody had given me a chance or whatever. And then my life changed almost overnight. Generally, I would say yes to opportunity because I got to see the world through that.
Did you make a lot of money, and was that important to you?
No, money was not important. It's never been a motivating factor. And I suppose I did okay.
And 30 was an important age. At that stage, I mean, you had actually started to build a career. You won gold medals in the RDS, but there was a kind of a rocky period. Things seemed to be a bit chaotic from time to time.
I studied in the Botanic Gardens in Glasnevin in Dublin, and I knew kind of coming up to my last year exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to go out and make gardens, but gardens that were different. I'd grown up in a fairly restrictive, dour, pebble-lashed grey society, and I wanted to rebel against that. I had a natural aptitude for creating gardens. I could sum up a plot very easily. I'd been brought up well. I was personable. I had good manners, so I could get jobs. But I wanted to explore ideas and line and shape and design and colour and materials and music and sound and in gardens, in outdoor settings, and I wasn't seeing any of that, and nobody else was seeing any of that. So yeah, it wasn't a problem for me to go and do the traditional or suburban garden for people or at flower shows, and I could do Twee very well, but it wasn't creatively fulfilling. After a while of not being able to move on or say anything different, gardening just stayed the same. And I didn't want that. So I ended up doing my work badly, not finishing jobs, bouncing checks, not wanting to walk down the street because I felt I'd let myself down and everybody else down, and kind of hiding away because something was stopping me just going out and doing a good job, a good normal job. I was striving to say something, so to get that creative urge out there. And when you don't have that outlet, it, well, for me, it became massively frustrating, and I ended up messing everything up.
And how much of that, Diarmaid, might have been due to your childhood? It wasn't the easiest childhood. There was a lot of sadness there, a lot of difficulties there, and maybe what you were going through when you were in your late 20s, was there perhaps an outworking of all of that?
Maybe. I don't think there was, but maybe, because I was always fairly solid inside and I always was stoic and strong and felt that I knew what my goals were. Yeah, childhood wasn't great. We one day when I was six, my brother was five, we were going to school and he was knocked down and unfortunately died. And that cast a pall, as you can imagine, over family life for, well, forever. That was challenging, and I certainly became insular. And I wouldn't say I had a lack of confidence, but I had a lack of social abilities. On a one-to-one, I could get on with people, but school days weren't great.
Were there other siblings in the family aside from Connor, who died tragically in that accident on the way to school?
Yeah, and I have an older brother, Declan, a couple of years older than me, and then two younger sisters who probably weren't so affected. And that was a great joy to see them getting on with life and whatever, because they were too young to understand.
Yeah, but I suppose, you know, I think you have described yourself in the past as a lonely child. I mean, despite having younger siblings, I mean, what was school like for you? Were you sporty, for instance?
No, I wasn't sporty. It was horrendous. I was sporty in that I loved running, I loved swimming, but I wouldn't have been into any of the football or... I still don't understand that whole culture. I could meet the biggest, and often have met the biggest stars, and well, I wouldn't have a clue who they are. So there's a whole area of Irish culture that has not penetrated.
I'm sure you've heard of Peter O'Mahony, a famous Irish and famous Munster rugby player.
I have.
And a famous gardener to
I have, indeed. When he was, I think he was in, were they in Japan for the World Cup? And I had to send him a list of gardens to visit. And then he said he was going to put them in the notice board so that all the lads could go out to get some peace and serenity. There's an English rugby player, Lawrence Delalia, and I did his garden. I got to know him fairly well. He himself and his wife became friends. But I could never talk to him about rugby because I haven't a clue what's going on.
Did you aspire to go to university?
I aspired to learn rather than go to university. I certainly wanted to learn my trade, but I learned as much of my trade working with inspirational gardeners. There was a great girl called Orla Sweeney. She came from a family who lived on Ackle Sound. And I worked with her in a shop called Mackie's Seeds, which was in Murray Street, in the 80s. And Orla used to bring me on projects when she was digging gardens. And Orla was such an innovator. And just the tips that I would pick up from people like her.
And when you managed to get things together, and obviously you were gifted and you applied yourself, the business side doesn't seem to have added up. I mean, you were broke for a time and homeless, or bordering on homeless at least.
Well, yeah, but yeah, I got it together in that so I could sell the idea of me making a garden. I could make a nice garden for people, but I wasn't being creatively satisfied. So one particular evening, I was living in a flat on Windsor Road in Ranelagh, and on the Friday evening, the guy from the rentals company came and repossessed the stack system, the old stereo system that I had rented, and he'd never repossessed. And he just looked at me kind of sadly as he was loading it into his van, because no, it was about £2 a week. And the following morning, the landlord took back the keys And I put all my possessions, which were just two bags of clothes, in black plastic bags. And my friend came along with his bicycle and he balanced them on the crossbar and he cycled them off to his dad's garage. And I had nowhere to go and nothing. And that was a very low point. So for somebody with perceived success, somebody who'd won all the medals or chose them and whatever, but somebody who didn't feel that the environment in which I was working was good for me, I had just messed up so much. And I'll never forget it. My parents lived in Refarnham and I was always welcome at home. But that would have been given up completely for me. So I remember walking in from Windsor Road to Dame Street and standing at the 16 bus and letting, because I had just enough money to get back home, to the family home. And I remember getting on that bus and going upstairs. And as I took the steps, I said to myself, right, each step you have to take now, no matter how small, has to be in the right direction in life. Because I wasn't young at that stage. I hadn't got a great reputation in the business because I was full of great ideas, great at talking about these ideas, great at wanting to move forward. But look where I was. My friends were buying houses and having children and I couldn't have been in a smaller place.
Was that your lowest point?
I've had plenty through the years, sometimes at the highest times that people would have perceived behind the scenes. It hasn't been great because I've risked everything to do something to get things. So it depends on what you would view at low. I never feel too far from those days.
Was it around that time when you were obviously in your, was it what, around the 30 mark?
Yeah.
That two women called Keane came into your life?
It was.
And changed it?
Yes, it was around that time. So I had again gone to what was called then the RDS Spring Gardening Festival, where they used to have a garden show every year, the forerunner to what's now Bloom. And I'd won the gold medal that year. And I remember what happened was there was somebody called Renata Coleman who'd bought a big castle down in Wicklow somewhere, Humewood Castle. And because I was the person who'd won that year, I went into the Botanic Gardens one Sunday afternoon just for a wander around because I love the place. And a gardener told me, oh, I know somebody who's looking for you. She just bought this big castle. And I went down to see this woman and she went to the garden then. And that never worked out. But when people started hearing that I was the one who'd been called to Hume Wood, the phone started ringing. And among the people who called me was this well-known journalist, Terry Keane. And I was a bit, let's say, nervous because Terry had a reputation of being, you know, slightly ferocious maybe sometimes. So she asked, would I create a garden for her? But I didn't get to design the garden. A brilliant gardener called Helen Dillon lived on the same road. Helen designed Terry's garden on the back of a packet of cigarettes and I was asked to carry out the work. And as usual, I went and worked very hard and it was an extraordinary house to work in for a few different reasons. So I would always work hard. I'd work from early in the morning to late at night, sometimes on my own, sometimes with a pal. Yeah, I remember working there on a Friday evening and somebody was going into dinner and it was an astronaut, Buzz Aldrin, who'd been on the moon and he was going into the house for dinner and that was the type of house. Everybody kind of went there. But the really interesting thing was, unlike many other places in Dublin, whoever you were, if you were working in the house, and they were, let's say, at the end of the day, having a beer, having a glass of wine, having a cup of tea, or if it was Sunday morning and they were having a fry, you got invited in. If you were an electrician, if you were the painter, if you were the gardener. That was unusual. And there I found people who were interested in the arts. A madhouse, kind of crazy house, with Granny, aged 93, who was living in the basements, Terry living at the top of the house, and then the kids and the parties and everything else kind of in between. So after a while, I became part of that household.
And clearly it might have been, you might have had to take a deep breath at the notion of not designing the garden, but implementing somebody else's design. But How did they begin to influence you, or at least help you, or persuade you, or cajole, or boss you into getting your act together?
I suppose belief and being around people who had... My parents were from inner city Dublin. They didn't have the luxury to absorb themselves in the arts, although my dad did in his own way. He was an opera buff and a very serious opera buff, but that wasn't the type of music I was interested in. But then in Terry's House, it was painters and it was sculptors and it was writers and it was, you got to meet kind of everybody who came. And I just loved that, being included in that sort of conversation. And I love the fact that as a gardener, you were appreciated.
I don't mean to be intrusive, but did you ever meet the man she occasionally referred to as Sweetie in her columns?
Oh, I did. I met Charlie. Yeah, I knew Charlie well. Charlie was very good to me. He was very kind to me. I didn't particularly want to meet him because I felt I was intruding a little bit, but I met him fairly early on. I met him down in Baltimore, and actually Terry wasn't there. There was a few of us there, and I didn't really want to be there because there was a group of friends having dinner, and the car pulled up to Baltimore, and there was Charlie outside, and he opened my door, and I sat beside him for dinner, and we kind of became mates, I would say. I was interested in politics. He was interested in people who made stuff and did stuff, and he was very encouraging and remained very encouraging.
Did he invite you to Conceely at any stage?
He did. I went to Conceely. Funny enough, at the same time, I was doing some work in Conceely, but I was also doing some work in the house that Gareth Fitzgerald lived in Ranelagh, because I was doing some work for Gareth's son, Mark, and his wife, Dervil. So I saw it all.
coming back, though, to how they influenced you, was it that they sort of invested you with belief that somehow gave you self-belief?
Absolutely that. Been taken seriously. Also, growing up with kind of South Dublin sensibilities, been kind of brought up the way everybody else was, to know your place. People who weren't going to be told what their place was, people who felt that they could be creative or have some fun or whatever, who could live maybe by slightly different rules, I really enjoyed. That kind of aligned with... There was something... When I was very young, my mom... I remember being in town with my mom and we walked past Trinity College. I asked her what that opening was, what that doorway was. And mom said to me, and mom was amazing, but she said to me, that place is not for the likes of you or me. We were very, and I think Irish people in general were very much brought up to know our place and be kept in our place, often by ourselves.
And how, because I mean, you're talking about the 80s, Diarmaid, and like it was free education courtesy of Donogh O'Malley for, 20 years and more at that stage. And then third level was opening up and were grants and so forth. I mean, was it own background or what?
No, I think it was the fact that there used to be a Protestant university, and until in my mum's kind of memory, you would have had to ask the Archbishop if you were a Catholic to go to that institution just to learn, you know, the biggest in the centre of the city. Another time that struck me with that same doorway was after Bloody Sunday, my parents put us in the car and drove us around Dublin City. So the following day, on the Monday, they brought us, and the city, we were only little kids at that stage, and the city was very tense. And my parents were very struck that there was a black drape from the window above that arched doorway, and they'd never seen that, the like of that before. Mm. So, and they felt an affinity, or that there was a different type of person showing affinity with an understanding what was happening. So,
when you decided to launch your assault, as it were, on the Chelsea Flower Show, one of the world's great shows and competitions, did you have the Keens in your corner at that stage?
I did, and Terry especially would have been, you just go for it, go for it, go for it. You know, do what you feel that you have to do. So other people would have been, just get a job with the Parks Department or just do some maintenance or whatever, because clearly what you're doing isn't working and this dream isn't working out. But Terry would have been, do whatever you can. And in fact, she got out her address book and wrote to everybody, handwritten letters to everybody. everybody she'd ever met, will you help this young lad? And it didn't really result in, it certainly didn't result in anybody opening a checkbook and support, but understanding that somebody would do that for me and somebody would believe was, you know, enough to fuel my belief.
And meanwhile, her daughter Justine was showing a certain belief and interest in you as well.
Well, at that stage, I was myself and Justine had got together, and yeah, she had kind of ultimate belief, and she was really the one sharing my dreams and ambitions with her mum.
And ultimately, though, you had to knock on some doors yourself. I mean, what did you do?
It all came about true. I had done my last garden in the RDS, and I'd won a gold medal. But the last garden was transporting a cottage from a kind of beat up old rubble cottage from Achill Island to the RDS arena and planting it with wildflowers. And it was pretty, and it was a cottage garden, and it was a kind of real active endeavour, I suppose, moving a whole building across the country. And Achill has some beautiful kind of purple pink stone, and when it rains, as it often does in Ireland, that really shines. So the whole thing, it really did look lovely. There were people walking around. There was a lady called Fionnuala Reid walking past the garden, and it was a week after the Chelsea Flower Show. She had just been to the Chelsea Flower Show. I knew her because she was a gardener in the Botanic Gardens, and she said to her friend, she looked at my garden and wasn't talking to me, and she said, that is almost Chelsea standard. And that intrigued me. So just overhearing this conversation, not engaging in conversation with Fionnuala at the time, it electrified me. It hit me like a thunderbolt. And I said, that's my escape. That's how I'll get somewhere. I didn't know much about Chelsea. I went back and looked in the golden pages to see if I could find this thing, the Chelsea Flower Show, but it didn't exist. And eventually I found an address for the Royal Horticultural Society, and I went over and knocked on their door, not knowing anything about it, and said, you know, said, can I do a garden at your show? And they pretty much booted me out of the place.
You might as well be asking for centre court tickets at Wimbledon.
Absolutely. And who do you think you are, and what have you achieved, and whatever. And I was really humiliated by that, because finding my way to London and being shy, yet going into this big building and then being directed up to the third floor to the shows department, and a guy coming out eventually and looking me up and down and making me feel so small. And I said, well, what do you do? And he said, you address a letter typed, he said, to Miss Mavis Sweetingham, outlining what you'd like to do and your achievements to date and photographs of your work and whatever. So I did all that, and I did all that within hours, and I got it back to them, but the building was closed at that stage. But then I got an application to submit a design for the following year's show.
And it took off from there.
Well, no. So I submitted the design, and I decided to give them a twee Irish garden, because I developed a plan. If I was coming from Ireland, they'd want something that looked Irish. I wanted to do something contemporary, but I felt I'd have a better chance of getting in the door, giving them their idea of Ireland. I drew up my design, sent it over, and I got the rejection letter. And that was devastating. But 6 months later, this Mavis Sweetingham rang, and she said, somebody's dropped out. We'd like to give you the chance, but you'd only have 6 months and you need £60,000. You know, I had less than nothing. And I begged for the chance, and they decided to give me the chance. But the upswing of that was that, yes, I had all the support from people like Terry, who probably got me in here, maybe even to the studio, to do an interview with Pat Kenny. And I'll never forget being feeling sick before I came in. And Pat said to me, if I had £60,000, I'd buy a red Ferrari. I wouldn't spend it on a garden at the Chelsea Flower Show. And that was the prevailing wisdom of the time. And I can't disagree with that. It came to the time that I still hadn't told him I had no money. So I arrived over in London with my friend, two of us, like two Paddington Bears with two suitcases, 300 quid in our pockets, and 3 weeks and 3 days to create my first garden at Chelsea with nothing. With no tools, no equipment, no place to stay, which a kind of glorious naivety, verging on foolishness. And what happened over the next 3 weeks, horrible and amazing, but we got a garden built. somehow.
Where did the £60,000 materialise?
It didn't. It didn't. It just didn't. About $3,000 did materialise. Well, in the middle of the job, or maybe towards the end. Fulch Ireland asked me to come back and have a meeting with the managing director, and I did. I came back with whatever last pennies I had, and I had this meeting on a Friday afternoon with the head man in Fulch Ireland and whatever, and I told him what we were doing. We were over there, and the meeting ended, Sean, and he said, yeah, we are going to give you this grant of $3,000, maybe $4,000, which would have, if you have nothing, it was massive. And the meeting ended. I said to him, what about the... Oh, he says, you'll get that when you're finished. And I walked out of there as devastated, because Vincent was over in London. The bloke had gone over with me, and he had hotwired the neighbours, JCB, and he was digging down because it was a bank holiday weekend. And there was a pipe running underneath our garden, and he'd gone through the pipe, and our garden was now a lake, and so was the Japanese garden next to us. And why he was hotwired, why he wanted to use the JCB, because we had no hurry because we were doing nothing. But anyway, that was that. But we got our garden made, we got it finished, and for all the lack of finesse that it had something.
Where did you get the plans from?
This was amazing. So around that time, Justin had agreed to get engaged. I'd proposed, and Justin had agreed that we...
Well, she knew she wasn't marrying money anyway, that's for sure.
She did. Luckily, she's never had any interest in that. This friend of her mum's, Noel Campbell-Sharp, had a house down in Ballinskelly. So she said, oh, you and Justin, you've been through a tough time with all the things that you want to do. You've been, take my cottage for a week. I go down to my house in Kerry for a weekend. I didn't bring Justin down. Myself and Vincent went down for a couple of weeks, and we dug up every plant that didn't move. From her garden, from bogs. We had Irish fertiliser industry bags in Noel's courtyard at the back of the house, filled with plants. I had no way of getting them to London. I had a pile of stone bought in North Dublin somewhere to build a what was to be a crumbling Irish tower and tower house and whatever. We'd had some support from the guys who were doing Ballygown in Newcastle West. They gave me something, and Gillian Boulder, the wonderful Gillian Boulder, had written me a cheque and whatever. So we had some support, but we didn't eat for the last 3 days. We didn't eat anything for the last 3 days.
Was that nerves or just no money?
We'd no money. We'd no money. We'd money for coffee. We were filthy. Then we ran out of a place to stay. We contemplated, it was 11 o'clock. We wandered out of that show so filthy, and we contemplated going and asking in the police station, could we sleep in the cell? But a pub gave us a room in the attic, and we took down the curtains to use as bed covers. That was the last night, the night before the show opened. And then we crawled in over the fence to finish our garden in the last few hours, just before it was judged and press day and all the royals came, and just before everybody from Ireland came to feed us.
What was the judges and the people's verdict?
The judges' verdict, we got a bronze medal. Now, you get a bronze medal for turning up. It's like writing your name on an exam paper. For turning up, you get a bronze medal. They give about 7 or 8 bronze medals, 6 or 7 silvers, 5 or 6 silver golds, then 5 or 6 golds, and then a best in show. We got a bronze medal. You couldn't go any lower. But we had got the garden up. We'd got it built, and it looked okay. We got the bronze medal. We sold the garden. We had enough money to clear out of Chelsea and to come home. And a few days later, we were in a pub in Dublin, and I was telling some girls that I knew. I used to teach gardening classes. And there were two girls, one called Anita Nataro and another called Ursula Courtney. And Anita and Ursula used to come to my classes, and they were younger than anybody else who came to class. So we'd go for a pint with them. And I was telling the girls in the pub about going to what had happened the week before. And they were agog at this. And the following day, Ursula rang me and she said to me, I didn't tell you last night. First, she said, first of all, was that story true? And I said, yeah. Was everything true? She said. I said, yeah. She said, I didn't tell you last night, but I'm a researcher with the Late Show. And she said, we have the premier of Newfoundland booked for next Saturday, but I think he's going to be very boring. Would you come on and tell the story the way you told it to me in the pub? And I went on. This was amazing, because nobody had noticed we'd been to Chelsea, you know, because it wasn't a big thing. So I went on with my family in the audience and friends in the audience that night, on the Saturday night, and told the story of Croydon the Garden at Chelsea. Told the story of the bronze medal. Everybody thought we came third at the Chelsea Frog Show, and we were away.
It was quite the rise afterwards, meteoric or otherwise, to go from that beginning, successful in a modest way, though you say it was, to the Sky Garden. That was Remind us about that. I mean, they're still writing about it in the Irish Examiner down there in Cork, I think.
It was, so, you know, I had a little bit of a voice then in Ireland after having brought a garden to Chelsea, but I still wanted to do the garden, though it didn't satisfy me creatively. I still wanted to change the world of garden design. So that meant going back and doing something that I believed in. I went back the following year and created a contemporary garden. Sean, it was beyond awful. It was terrible. Midway through building the garden, I knew I hadn't got it. I couldn't do it. I was again letting everybody down, but letting everybody down in the biggest auditorium, gardening auditorium in the world. It was embarrassing. People, as we were building, used to come and just look at us and shake our heads and wander away. And if you know yourself, it isn't working. It's devastating. BBC came along and said they wanted to record something about young gardeners doing gardens at Chelsea, and I was young. It was the only thing I had going for me at the time. They recorded a piece with Alan Titchmarsh, which was amazing, in the garden. At that stage, I didn't like what they were doing. The garden was based on the men's toilets in the Pod nightclub in Dublin. Where water poured down over.
Yeah, I've seen some footage of it right now.
New exotic planting in front of it, and then the Billie Jean video, Michael Jackson, when he walks down, when he dances down the sidewalk, every time his foot touches the pavement, it illuminates. So I combined all of this, realised it didn't work. Alan came along, recorded something. I told him it lit up at night. He said he'd be back to see it at night. He wasn't, but for me in the garden at night, I watched the programme transmit and hated it. But everybody that was with me said that was cool. And I went back to Chelsea and there were crowds around the garden. It had looked brilliant on television and my life changed after. Yeah, it just changed overnight then. And
did you get a prize for it?
No, impossible not to get a prize. We didn't. We didn't get a prize. We got a letter to say, wrap up and don't come back, pretty much, very politely. It's impossible not to get an award at Chelsea. Absolutely impossible. And no, and the garden became a sensation.
But obviously, you know, you got huge publicity out of it. And then you did have a great triumph with your Sky Garden.
Well, I think the following year I was into Channel 4 had the rights to the coverage of Chelsea, and it was me and Monty Don presenting. Just 1 year later, me and Monty Don presenting the show of Chelsea. And then I went on to do that with Alan. But eventually I went back to doing gardens on the ground because I didn't like the critiquing of other gardens. I was very honest about it because I believed in kind of contemporary design and wanting to see something different. And then eventually, yes, we did the Irish Sky Garden in I can't remember.
You got a bit more than the 3,000 from Bord Fáilte, or Fáilte Ireland as it was then.
We did. It was I did
1.7 million from Fáilte Ireland.
No, and we then, didn't. No, no. Well, no, I think what that refers to is the cost of building the park in Cork subsequently. Most gardens at Chelsea would cost between 300 and 500,000, even now. It's kind of huge money.
This concept, it was suspended from what, a crane?
So, yeah, it was called the Irish Sky Garden. I think it was 2011. We did it in association with Cork City Council and the Midsummer Festival and Fáilte Ireland. And it was to advertise Ireland. So on the ground, it was a very green landscape. And then you had this pavilion that you'd walk into, and all of a sudden the pavilion would rise 20 metres up into the air, a huge thing flying up into the sky. And it was quite extraordinary, and yeah, it won all the awards at Chelsea this year. And then a couple of weeks after coming home became highly controversial because of the budget, I think.
It kind of came crashing back to earth, if you pardon the phrase, in the sense that the ultimate destination was in a park in Cork.
And I think the budget may refer to the whole refurbishment of that park. So it doesn't refer to the garden at Chelsea. But that's certainly what the guidelines. And actually, Sean, I think I had to do a Freedom of Information Act myself to get all the files to kind of point out that not only did we not get that money, I would have lost money on that particular project. But, you know, 2 weeks later, it was on the front cover of the biggest garden design magazine in America. So they got, whoever sponsored it, got their, the message was out there, and it was all about Green Ireland and doing something different and exploring something different. I'll never forget. It was kind of surreal because you had to, there were two Lutyens benches. Lutyens was a British, Edwin Lutyens, British architect. He made these, designed these benches in Edwardian times. We had them in the pavilion that flew up. And I'll never forget being up there with John Major, with Norman Major, with Helen Mirren, and John Major telling me he was a free, he'd been given the freedom of Cork back in the day. The people you met up there, but the influence that garden had, I think, is still around today. And it's been, so everything in the garden went back to Cork. So whatever about, there was a return on the investment.
And also it helped to solidify your reputation, which I suppose, you know, was at its peak at that stage. Tell me about how you developed then the business arising or flowing from those exhibitions and the prizes and the creativity that you were, and also mixing with the great and the good, beginning with serious royalty.
In terms of what it did for me, it just shut everybody up because we got the gold medal and we got the People's Choice Awards and all of that sort of thing. I was never interested in medals. So I realised my first time at Chelsea what medals meant, because there were other people looking for a gold medal doing their first garden. And we got the bronze medal and whatever. But when I saw the disappointment of other gardeners who hadn't got the grasp for gold, I just said, if you knew our story, it's been about getting here and getting the garden made. And I also realised that it's easy to get a gold medal because there's a formula to doing a garden at Chelsea, if you're competent in the, you know, in making one of these gardens, which we are. Just follow the formula, give them what they want and they'll give you a gold medal. I was never interested in that. So once we had a gold, they'd all shut up and I'd be allowed then do whatever I wanted to do, which was push the boundary. I've never turned up for the prize giving. I've never, when you are judged at one of these shows, you get to address the judges. I've said, look, just have a look at it and whatever you think. After the show, you're allowed to go to the judges, or they come to you and you're allowed to quibble with them and say, why did you? Never ever done that. The only comment I've ever given was, whatever they gave me, even if they gave me nothing, we're very happy. Because I see it as a forum to do something different. So after that, there was a certain amount of freedom. I thought people would leave me. You know, that question, will he ever go? Oh, at least that's answered. And then, yeah, it led to stuff. But really, the only thing I'm interested in is doing gardens that are slightly different and saying something.
For somebody who might have a reputation as a name dropper, you've only mentioned John Major and so far. I mean, you did have a lovely conversation with Her Late Majesty Queen Elizabeth, and I think you had several conversations with Prince Charles, as he then was, now King Charles.
Yeah, it comes with the territory. Once you become so, what had happened after the second garden is I got a career in television. When you get a career, which kind of developed slowly over 8 or 10 years and then got fairly manic at a certain stage, when you get to that stage in British life, you become a commodity. So you're wheeled out to everything. So you get to go to the places of, you know, all the museums, all the parties, all the palaces and Downing Street and all of that. It just becomes part. I suppose in time I've become a little, not cynical, because I enjoyed every moment of that and there was a certain amazement with it, but they're using you, you're using them.
And what was it like engaging with Her Majesty?
That was fine. And very lovely in a way. When she, a week after she'd been to Ireland, Epi got to present her with flowers at Chelsea. And then, but you'd meet her every year because you'd do a garden, and I had done a garden with Terence Conran, who was a sir. And so to stand with him and see his joy in that when she came around was great. But I'd got up to all sorts of no good at Buckingham Palace at parties and had lots of fun with my mates there. So I tell you who was really lovely and who was and kind of normal, because none of the rest of them are normal. Zara Phillips, Princess Anne's daughter. She was great.
You're clearly quite a socially conscious person, Jeremy. I mean, do you find it hard to keep your mouth shut, say, on global politics when you might meet various dignitaries, or would you have a frank exchange with them?
I've learned my lesson. I've become an ambassador with the UN, with their FAO organisation.
That's the Food and Agriculture,
Organisation. Yeah, organisation. So I've done a lot with them over the last few years. When I was younger, I'd speak out. I don't speak out anymore. Also, I think, so I was a supporter of the Labour Party in Tony Blair's time, and I really became disillusioned then. I used to go to their annual kind of dinner dance on Park Lane every year. And I remember in the height of the Iraq war, being at that and being at a fairly big table at that, and the Iraq war not been mentioned. Up until recently, I've been very aware of what's happening politically pretty much everywhere. And for that not to be acknowledged, I found that hard.
Elsewhere in the Middle East, you were invited, I think, to design a garden around the presidential palace in Syria.
You really have done your homework. Yes, we'd been asked to design the gardens of the presidential palace in Syria and said no, obviously. And they were really, really offended.
Obviously, why?
Well, because he was gassing his people.
And that was happening at that stage?
At that stage, yeah. And it was through an intermediary. It wasn't them. So it was their consultant.
Yeah, I was going to ask, how did the approach come? Yeah.
Yeah. So their consultant came to meet me at the Chelsea Flower Show.
Mohammed Al Fayed was another client of yours.
Yeah. Obviously, I didn't know then what I know now. But Mohammed Al Fayed wasn't the client. Harrods was the client. But that was interesting. There was a certain time in my life where I was very celebrated in England. And Selfridges was a very cool department store. I had this idea that I'd love to design the windows of Selfridges. I engaged with this conversation with Selfridges and agreed to design the windows, not knowing that my agent was engaging with Harrods. The designers from Selfridges and Harrods were at a party. And one says to the other, we have Dermot McGavin doing the windows. This got back to my agent, who went mad because Harrods were paying, Selfridges weren't. So I ended up doing the windows for, which was mad, all of the windows for Harrods. And that was a big design project in itself. And then Mohammed Al Fayed, on one particular evening, closed the store to host a party for me one evening. And that was mad. But that's London life. That's the sort of thing that happens when you have a glow around you.
Am I right in thinking, Jeremy, that you no longer party like you did?
Well, it's funny. The main programme I did for the BBC was a programme called Homefront. And one of the directors was over at a wedding 3 weeks ago. She was telling me how she didn't party anymore. I said, oh, I don't. You know, I want to be in bed at 9 o'clock or whatever. She said, you know, you were always like that. When you were working, you were working. Because I would ban alcohol anywhere near gardens. We worked so hard on these projects that, and we were so tired. And at the end, once or twice, there were parties and there was some inappropriate stuff. Or people said stuff that would, you know, the client might say something to one of the lads or whatever. And I just said, let's just keep it professional. But when I wasn't working, like every year you'd be invited to the Hootenanny, Jules Holland. And I'd always end up with on a table with Mo Molan because of the Irish connection. And there's a rock band in Britain, I think they're Scottish, called Primal Scream. And they were party animals. And I was a gardener. And here I am at Television Centre at 3 o'clock in the morning. And they're asking me to show them the Blue Peter Garden, which is this famous garden built in probably the 70s. And they rearrange it at 3 o'clock in the morning and were ejected from the BBC. That sort of party I absolutely loved, to get the opportunity to do that and to see all that. But now, no.
What's this about skinny dipping in Buckingham Palace?
I didn't. I nearly did. I nearly did. I was with one of the, we were at a party there and it was in the grounds. I think it was one of the garden parties and I was with one of the lads from Top Gear. The two of us, whenever we were together, were a bit mischievous and we had this bet on would we do this, because there was a beautiful pond way away from and there was an island and we thought, would we have a swim to the island? But we decided not to. The following week, we were watching the news and somebody did this. I was watching the news with my wife and she said, just thank God, that's one thing you didn't do. But somebody did. But we nearly did.
Will you ever go back to Chelsea?
Yeah, but you only go back if you've something that you really want to do and need to do. And unfortunately, the next one I need to do is really big. I've been working on it for about 12 years. It says something. So it has a kind of social commentary. It would take up 4 plots, which they've already agreed to give me. It'll be a tough one. It'll be very, very tough. So hopefully I get back with that.
When?
I don't know.
12 years. It's a fairly long gestation, isn't it?
It is, but it's been on the drawing board that long. You have to understand it yourself.
And what are you going to say in it?
Nothing that would annoy my mum. it's just different. It looks at traditional gardening. It looks at estate gardening. It looks at the environment.
Will you ever retire?
No, no, I won't ever retire. I don't think gardeners ever retire. And I've a lot to do. In some ways, I think I'm only getting started. Absolutely think that I'm on the verge of my biggest project ever, a transformative project that, again, a little bit like the Chelsea one that I've worked years in the background to do something with. So, no, gardening has the ability to change so much and there's no better
place to do it. Tell me more about that.
No.
Jim and Gavin, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sean.
To hear more in this series, go to rte.ie/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.